deal of hunting and fishing over in the Kingston Peninsula, a great large crowd of us practically every weekend. We also attended many of the country dances over there, both in Kingston itself, Apple Grove, generally speaking. Such interesting, the most interesting orchestra that played over through that area was Messer, and sometimes we did a lot of sailing in those days, and sometimes we would sail up to Chapel Grove and spend the weekend there and attend the dance. Leaving school, we organized a junior hockey team out of Rothsay, known as the Rothsay Oaks. It was organized by Ted Patstone and four or five of us. Everybody provided all their own equipment and their own sticks for the early part of the season, and we were able to raise enough money to buy sweaters for the team. We started off in a slow way, but we got going. We got into the playoffs, and we eventually won the playoffs and went to finally played off against the Moncton Red Indians, losing to them, I think, on a 5-3 and a 6-3 score, but they went on to become the Canadian champions that year, and I think three of their players went to play for the Canadians the next year. I know that Claude Burke, spelled B-U-R-K-E, was the goaltender in that team, and he went next year and became Claude Burke, spelled B-O-U-R-Q-U-E, as the goaltender for the Canadians. And it was interesting to see that we were able to score six goals on the goalie who next year was the Canadians' goalie. And the Oaks turned senior and played in the Southern New Brunswick League as a senior team and did quite well there. I think we ended up as third, perhaps second, I don't know. And we finally gave it up. I got polio and put me out of hockey for a while, and eventually went back and played hockey in the Commercial League. And then that season, Sussex, because we weren't registered, we were free agents, Sussex asked us to go and play for them. And my brother Bill and I and a chap named Donnie Marshall, who I think later went on to play professional hockey, we went and played 22 or 23 games for Sussex in the playdowns that year and won them all except one, and that was the one that defeated us for the Maritime title. We did win the New Brunswick title. Rothsay, with the outbreak of World War II, and went off and served in the Navy for 30 years. I had an interesting, very interesting, and particularly lucky time, accompanied by good fortune on almost everything I ever did. A service in World War II in the North Atlantic and with the Americans and with the Royal Navy and raids on, five, six, or seven time raids along the Norwegian coast against the German forces, and worked with the Russians out of Russia, did the Murmansk convoys, fought in the English Channel, did the Normandy invasions, served in the Mediterranean and the Pacific, navigator on the first ships that went in to the invasion of Normandy. We went in a destroyer Algonquin and took the batteries out and watched the invasion roll in behind us that morning. Coastal forces and then fleet mine sweepers and then corvettes, but most of all of my service was in destroyers. I later served in the Korean War and was out there for quite a while, serving most of my time in North Korea, up in the China Sea and the Yellow Sea, Japan, both on the east and west coasts of Korea. Some amazing storms at sea ran through several, perhaps three or four typhoons, and took the first one of our Canadian warships that to circumnavigate the world, which was kind of interesting. The interesting things I remember about the early part of my life, I guess in the early 20s, sometime in the 20s, was Rupert Turnbull. Rupert was always a fascinating man. And he came back. He had already invented, along with Hanley Page, he'd invented the curve in the airplane's wing, the foil that we all know nowadays. And when he came back, he built a plane with floats. The plane was built out of iron pipe and had little stubby wings. And he used to get out there on the river and run this thing up and down the river. And a lot of the natives used to laugh at him. They thought that Rupert had lost his marbles. And they said to him one day, Mr. Turnbull, that plane, I don't really think it's ever going to fly. And he said, oh, you think not, eh? Well, we'll see. And he continued to do that. And what he was doing is he was working on the invention of the variable pitch propeller. And when he had finished the design and had been successful with it, he took the plane apart, and it was for many years down behind their summer place in the park, which was known as the barn. One of the other interesting things was I used to occasionally sail with Rupert, and he'd had a little open boat made, about 20 feet long, very handy little boat, with a not too large a sail on it. And I was helping him bail it out one day, and he was puffing away in his pipe, and he said, we have to keep bailing this all the time, every day it rains. He said, I think we could fix that. And the next day he came down, he'd taken a piece of 2x4 and he chopped a propeller out of it, quite a neat job of a propeller. And he'd made up a rod from that propeller, and he'd bored a hole in the strap that held the jib stay, and ran the rod through that and back to another little gear that went down to a pump in the bottom of the boat. And the little propeller spun around in the front and whenever there was any rain or water, it just pumped it out, and it was always pumped dry. I think he could sail it with the propeller still on, but he used to go up and unhook it, take it off, and when he went sailing. I remember going one day sailing with him, and we went over to his cottage on the island. And while I was there, I was surprised to find that his outhouse, which was up in the hill behind the cottage, had no sides or back or top or anything on it. It sat up there all by itself. And I said to Rupert, Mr. Turnbull, that's awfully immodest, isn't it? Well, he said, I suppose it is, he said, but I like after breakfast to go up there and take some papers up there with me. And he said, don't you think it might be silly if I had it all built and I had to open a door and I had to back in and close the door and sit there in the dark? He said, now I go up there with my papers and I, on a nice day, and I read my papers and I look out over the water and it's a lovely sight. And he said, you know, I know it's immodest, but I sometimes feel like a monarch. The other things that happened during my period in Rossi were is that there were three train wrecks all in the same place down there at the culvert that runs over Taylor's Brook. And I remember one of them particularly was a big freight with a lot of cars and was going pretty fast, so a great many of them went off the rails and piled up one over the other. And they were, on that occasion, there were quite a few of them were loaded with grain. And in one of them, there was a car full of sneakers. And I remember walking down to look at it and hear all these kids were trying on sneakers. But strangely enough, there were three successive wrecks right exactly in that same spot. Another interesting thing was that when the airplanes first came into vogue and they started to try and fly the mail, somebody had a contract to fly in the mail. I think it was from Moncton to St. John or some sort of a maritime mail circuit. And he was flying, I've forgotten the name of the, I can't just think of the name of the of the aircraft. I think it was a little Fairchild. And his engine quit over Rossi, and he had to come down on the ice. And he came down on the ice and just, I think, at Kinghurst. And he had to leave it there overnight. And when he came back, the souvenir hunters had cut great patches out of the sides of the thing and done substantial damage to the aircraft. On another occasion, there was an aircraft lost its engine, and or the engine quit on him, and he had to land in the upper field, or just above the upper field at RCS. And it was a little short field, and in order, when he got his engine fixed, to take off again, it was going to be a short run. And so they lashed the plane up to a tree, at the tail of the plane up to a tree at the end of the field. And then he revved his motor up as hard as he could, and then somebody with an axe cut the rope, and away he went, and he got off and got over the trees at the other end and disappeared. And one of my classmates, who still lives in the village, was a keen aviator in those days, and he used to take his flying every now and again. And I think that was Tim Ellison. I think Tim had a landing one morning on the Riverside Golf Club. He was flying with a very attractive girl, I know, on that occasion. I don't know whether he was just doing a little sensational flying that morning or whether there was something really wrong. Another interesting thing that I failed to mention when I was talking about Rupert Turnbull. In 1956 or 57, I was chief of staff in Washington, D.C. for the Canadian Naval Staff there, and also a naval attaché on the staff of the ambassador. And one of my colleagues was the representative of the Defense Research Board, a scientist by the name of Johnny Green. And Johnny, I think, was an aeronautical engineer, an aeronautical designer. And he was telling me that he came down in the 1930s and collected a lot of the material from Rupert to take back to the museum in Ottawa. And I think the Aeronautical Aviation Museum in Ottawa was named after Rupert. But he said at that time that the data that Rupert produced in 1902 in his wind tunnel that he was operating in Rossay, that's before the Wright brothers flew, was still being used and was still valid at that time, which was 1956 or 1957. I thought that was pretty good. But you'd have to really know Rupert to know what it was like. He was such a simple, nice, uncomplicated man. And it's wonderful to think that a man of that ability and that character was one of the great ones in the world. Later, I spent a couple of days, two or three days or 4 days, with John Allen Douglas McCurdy, who was the first chap to fly an aircraft in the British Empire. And he spoke, when he knew I was from Rossi, he spoke with great respect of Rupert and the work that Rupert had done. One of the other things in the early days of Rossay, hockey and things like that, actually they played, I think, mostly in St. John, but there were three Gilbert brothers who were quite good hockey players, and Brad Gilbert, the youngest one of them, in my day, was the coach of one of the St. John teams. But when I first started playing hockey, there were no lines on the ice, and you had to pass the puck back in the same manner you do in English rugby, and that used to trap people behind the goals in their own end, and they couldn't get out of it. So Brad Gilbert went down one year and suggested to the National Hockey League an idea of putting blue lines on, and behind the blue line you could pass forward. You could pass forward up to the blue line, and also you'd be able to body check people behind this blue line. And they thought that it was a silly idea, and so he came back and nothing happened. And the following year, they took it up seriously, and I think the year after that or that year, they introduced blue lines into hockey. And prior to that, when I first started playing hockey, there were 7 hockey players on the ice. There was the ones that we know now, plus a rover. And with the introduction of the blue lines, and followed shortly afterwards the red line, the whole game of hockey changed considerably. But initially, you could only pass forward, you could only pass the puck forward in your own end behind the blue line, and you could only check the man with the puck in your own defending zone. Those three Gilberts were Harry Gilbert, who was also a great fisherman and built and made beautiful fishing rods out of maple and beech and greenheart. And the other Gilbert was Walter Gilbert, and he lived down in the park, and his daughter came to our farm over here in Nova Scotia a few years ago and introduced herself. I last knew her, she was a flaming and beautiful redhead, and now she was a white-haired old lady. The things that happen as you get old. So there was Harry Gilbert and Walter Gilbert and Brad Gilbert, all hockey players in their day. These are some very rambling and somewhat disjointed thoughts and memories of the days of yesteryear when I lived in Rossay. If they're of any value, you would like me to straighten them up a little bit. I noticed as I played them back that on the starts and stops, quite often the first few words are left out. Should you want me to give you a better tape, if they are of any value, I would be pleased to try and do that sometime. Out. I have concerning my associations with Rossay, New Brunswick. I was born at the junction of the Hampton and the Gondola Point roads in the Kendi House in the Red Room on September the 22nd, 1915. The first son of Ethel and Ralph M. Steele. My earliest recollections of the Kendi House complex is of the stables that were associated with the hotel. I think there were at least 12 single stalls and 4 box stalls and a tack room and also great posts that stuck out that the harness was hung on up and down the corridor behind the single stalls. There was an enormous oat bin in the hayloft, and beside it was another bin in which either shorts or bran were stored. And these great enormous boxes were lined with sheet metal to keep the rats out, and there were quite heavy covers on hinges that came down on top of that. The farmers coming from the Kingston Peninsula would leave home early in the morning and would arrive in Rossay about 8 o'clock, and some of them would stop for breakfast and then go on into the market. They would return again just about dusk and take the horses down and unharness them and rub them down and put them in one of the single stalls and feed them, and then come up to the Kendi House and have dinner, go back and harness the horses and go back across the ice to the Kingston Peninsula. There were 2 dining rooms in the Kendi House. One was for the live-in residents and higher paying guests, and the other dining room was for the farmers who came by where they could have a meal at much lower cost. There were 4 horses associated with the hotel at that time. There was Victoria, and I've forgotten the other name. They were a matched black pair. And there was Charlie, the workhorse, and Kitten, the little driving horse. There were a number of carriages, and there was an express wagon, and there was a lumber wagon, and there was a sloven, and there was a dump cart. All of these kind of interesting and having their own tasks. The travel back and forth to the city was practically all by train, and the horse and carriage, or the horse and or Charlie and the Sloven went down to meet trains, usually at least once during the day. And they would bring up all sorts of things, from barrels of gasoline to fuel the one or two cars there were in the village, to heavy equipment or barrels of flour or other requirements for the hotel. And the carriage, or I think it was a phaeton, would go down with the black pair to pick up guests that would be arriving for the hotel. There were no paved roads at that time, and there was a great deal of traffic with horses and carriages going by. Quite often during the day there would be carriages that would be coming out of the city and going on either up through towards Moncton or going up towards Gondola Point to catch the ferry at Gondola Point. My earliest memories of the ferry at Gondola Point was arriving there with my grandparents in a carriage with Kitten early when the spring freshet was on. I think it must have been in 1919. And Kitten wouldn't, the landing ramp was in the water, out in the water, and the horse refused to go out in the water, just refused to enter the water to get on the ferry. And my grandfather got out very quietly and took her by the reins and walked into the water with her and led the horse up onto the loading ramp and then onto the ferry. The ferry at that time was the new cable ferry, and the old sail ferry was hauled up on the beach on the Reed's Point side of the operation. Lane Beehive in Rothsay back in those days was the station, and there would be usually either in the morning when they were departing or in the evening when they were coming back, there'd be at least 20 people around the station besides those getting on and getting off the train, so there was quite a large mob. And as a consequence of this, one of the key figures around was the station master. And the station master, as I remember him, was a chap named Ting Peters, and he was a very dapper little sort of a bantam rooster sort of a man who wore Bedford cords and sort of riding boots. An interesting sort of chap. There was a number of trains that went through during the day, and some of them didn't stop, but the mail was taken down for one of the through trains. And there was an arrangement, a stand that was by the entry to the park, and the bag of mail was put, special type of bag was put up on that, and it was held out, swung out, so when the train went by, the mail car had an arm they raised out, and it caught the bag and pulled it off this affair, and then the mail was taken in and sorted. The same time they were doing this, they kicked the bags of mail out the door, and they rumbled along beside the train and were picked up by whoever looked after the mail. Remember in 1919 or 1920 that Strathmaber, the Umakai house, was built. And on the site where it presently is today was the house that the Mac Mackays turned into their home. So they moved the house off the site where Strathmaber was to be built and moved it down close to the bridge and rebuilt it. Strathmaber was built, quite an interesting, probably the biggest house in the village was being built during my day. I remember the spring of 1923. It was an enormous flood that year, and it was also the year in which some of Canada's Olympic team came and stayed at the Kennedy House and did their training up at RCS on a new track that had been built for that purpose. I just can't remember the names of the people there, except the local contender was Beep Malcolm, who was a shot putter. One of my early memories again in Rosay was probably again in 1919, when I was eating my breakfast and looking out across at the village grocery store. And it was run at that time by a chap named Ren Robertson. And later, Lou Merritt took over from him. At that time, Lou worked as one of the clerks in the store. But I was eating my breakfast, and all of a sudden, I got very excited because cars were very scarce at that time, but this car came up, and there were hitching posts in front of the platform around the store at that time for them to wrap the reins of your horse around and while you went in and shopped. But this Model T Ford, a touring Ford, came up to the thing and stopped, and then all of a sudden jumped right up across the platform and right through the plate glass window, completely getting its front wheels well inside the store. And I started to shriek, and my grandmother came over and told me to get on and eat my breakfast. But and she looked out, and then she said to my grandfather, "Oh, look, Joe, there's a giant insect that's just jumped through the window of Ren Robertson's store, and it's probably consuming everything inside, including Ren." I thought that was a fascinating comment. The other big events of the day was when they paved the road. I don't know, it must have been about 1922, perhaps, 21 or 22. Before that, it had just been a gravel road, and they paved it by coming along and pouring enormous amounts of tar down and sprinkling sand on top of that. And one of the fascinating things to do at that point was to go out and dig chunks off the side of the road and chew it all afternoon. Gave us the iron jaws that later stood us in good stead. In the early 20s, my grandfather pastured his cows. I think there were five of them, five or six, was pastured on what is now the village common. And they were brought home every evening, put in the cow shed and milked and fed. And the next morning after they were milked, they were driven up around past the, in between the two stores and up the road and the bars lowered, and they were put in the pasture for the day. Later, that disappeared and became the village common. One of the other interesting things, the store opposite to Ren Robertson's store was run by an amazing character when I was very young, and that was Captain Billy Thompson. He was a seagoing man, and I don't know whether he was captain of one of the wood boats that ran down to Rockland, Maine, or whether he was a deep sea man, but he used to fascinate me. He looked like a sailor, and he chewed tobacco and spat it on the floor, which sort of disgusted me, but I thought probably that all sailors did that. Later, he passed away, and Norman Diggle, who had been working as a steward in the Union Club, had come over from England to work in the Union Club as a steward, I think either bought or rented the store, and he would come out on the train each morning, and he cleaned up the store and drove all the rats that were in it out and reopened the store and operated that store for many, many years. During the very early years, he operated an ice cream parlor in the back part of the store, which wasn't profitable for too long, and it disappeared. But he continued for years to get ice cream from Sussex. Came down on the train every day in a great big wooden tub with, I think, probably a 5-gallon can in the center packed in ice. And that tub of ice cream, it was a big wooden tub. That tub would last for quite a number of days. And you could go along and put your big nickel on the counter and get an ice cream cone and walk away merrily, happily. But after the ice cream parlor disappeared, you couldn't get cream sodas or whatever it was he served there. I used to be fascinated when I was young watching him carve the bacon. The bacon came in big slabs, and it was carved, sliced off, and he would slice it very carefully and then cut it away from the rind and wrap it in the butcher's paper and tie it up like a butcher, and you packed it off home. Drive me crazy because he was all alone there, and he used to get his lunch or what was really quite a good dinner from the Kendi house, and I used to have to go over each day and take his dinner over to him, and he used to always say the same thing: "I hope the potatoes were fried and buttered." Made to tears for the year or two I did that. Other things that was of interest, they assembled four Ford cars in Rossay in the early 20s one year. The cars came shipped in freight cars, all unassembled. That is, I think there were 14 or 18 cars, and there would be 14 frames all lashed together, and the fenders for 14 of these cars, the 14 bodies all sat one inside each other, and the engines all came separately crated, and they were brought up to what had been taken away from the stable, from the livery stable, and made into a garage. And Wilbur Crawford from Kingston came down with a number of men, and he assembled these and started them up and drove them off, and he was the agent for that shipment of cars. Although he sold all the cars, he gave up that idea. But it was interesting to think that that at one point cars were built in Ross. The other features in the 20s was the magnificent herd of shorthorns that the tailors had. And these, and representatives of this herd were shipped off every year to the Canadian National Exhibition. And one of the magnificent parades down through the village was their great, big, magnificent bull that often won the top award. And his name was Mac Roy, and he'd be led down last after the cows had all been loaded. And he'd been loaded in freight cars. And they didn't go up in cattle cars. They went up in regular freight cars. And one end of the freight cars were made up for the attendants to go along with them. That went on for quite a number of years. There were events in the 20s, I believe, yes, in the 20s, where several prepackaged houses were built in the village. One right next to St. Paul's Sunday School was built for Annie Punnington. And everything came all cut and ready to be assembled, and was assembled and put together. Very nice house. My in-laws lived in it in later years. And another one was the house, up on to John Davidson's home. It was also a pre-cut and pre-packaged house. Was built up on whatever that lane is called now. It was the lane on which Rupert Turnbull's road, and Nancy Daniel lived on that road. And George Crosby presently lives on that same road, lane. General McLean, who lived in the lovely stone house that had been built by and bought by General McLean, he was made lieutenant governor, and he had a magnificent long Packard car with a liveried chauffeur all dressed in brown, very smart-looking thing, and he used to parade around the village. There were a number of other chauffeurs in the village at that time. Kelty Morton was a very famous one. He was the Hawley chauffeur, and Jack Hawley had a Stutz Bearcat, which Kelty used to sit in the front seat with him and pump the superchargers, and he'd go tearing through the main junction there at Rossay. And the pavement ended there, so when they struck the gravel roads, there was an enormous shower of gravel and dust went up. That whole family sort of fell on bad times, and I saw Jack during World War II acting as a waiter in the Nova Scotian Hotel. A long way from the days when he used to drive the Stutz Bearcat. Sunday mornings in the summer were always interesting days, with the people stylishly clad walking off to church on Sunday morning. And one of the more humorous and comic characters was a fellow called Hebert Broom. Quite an interesting, nice chap. In later years, much later years, my Uncle Arthur Kennedy lived in the house that was the Broom house. And one morning, and a lot of the people who went to church for several years used to walk down after church to the Rossay Wharf, where there was quite a lot of yachting activity and a lot of swimming on Sunday mornings. And Heber went down on this morning with his wife, and he'd just been in church, and he was clad in white flannels and a blazer and a boater, a straw hat. And they got there, and there was quite a group assembled. And suddenly Heber said, "It's a lovely day. I think I'll go for a swim." And with that, he proceeded to disrobe, much to the consternation of everybody. And he took his time at it. And finally, he peeled his pants down and revealed he had his swimming trunks on underneath. And he dove in the water and went off. Great sensation for that week. That time, Art Fairweather had a sailboat there. It was called the Old Baloney, and a more aptly named yacht I couldn't think of. Other interesting features of the village in my early years was the village blacksmith's shop. And during dull times, it was always fun to go down there and watch the blacksmith at work. And perhaps sometimes he'd let you handle the bellows. And I remember early on, he went from the hand bellows, which were operated by a pole with a great big set of bellows. He went to mechanical bellows, which were wound to handle. And sometimes he'd let you turn it, and there was the peculiar smells of that place. There would sometimes be a pair of horses, big draft horses, and a riding horse and a carriage horse all there at the same time. Usually just before the winter season came on, they used to change the shoes from the summer shoes for the horses to the winter shoes, the ones that were sharper and worked well on ice. There were two types of shoes that I remember. There were the ones that were made by the blacksmith right there. And then there were the manufactured ones that came, and they were fitted, and they had corks in them that you could wind out so that you just took a wrench and you wound the threaded in corks for the summer thing, wound those out and put the winter corks in. They were quite different. Once or twice when I was there, they had a horse that was difficult and would kick, and that was very scary. The horses were gentle and well behaved. It was an interesting place to be. There were all sorts of strange smells. The fire was burning coke, and the blacksmith would reach in with his big sort of scoop and stir it around and heap it up and put his metal in the thing and take it out and look at the color of it. And it was interesting to watch him temper various things that he was making. And it seemed to me that he would go by the color of them to some extent, but he would work away at a piece, and he would work, and if it was something that had to have a hard edge along one side, he'd work away at that and keep dipping it in the great oaken bucket of water that was there, then re-hammer it and reheat it and hammer it and then dip it in the water again. It made a peculiar smell combined with the coke. And then when he was working on the horses, he made the shoe up for the horse, and then he heated it and worked it, and then he would go and put it on the horse's hoof while it was still very hot, and would burn itself into the hoof a little bit. I presume that this helped to keep the whole thing sort of sterile and made it fit very tightly, but it raised a very peculiar stink. For a number of years to school at the Rossley Consolidated School, which was quite a new school at that time, and the old school, the big brick school that still, I think, exists there as the elementary school, but the old school was right across the street, and it was turned into a service station, and later after that became part of the fire department. But I played football and rugby, that is, and I played hockey and took part in the track meets at Rossley Consolidated. And I got some of my early medical education in grade 2 or grade 3 when quite a bit older and very much larger Indian who went to school with us there, Peter Alexander, gave us a long, detailed description of how he was being treated for his gonorrhea. That was in grade 3, where I went to Rothsay and my on the Rothsay Collegiate on the Hill, and my education was further expanded by a number of characters who came, one of which was Horace Burpee Tucker from Bermuda. And Horace was sent there because he'd come home one evening with too much to drink and had made passes at his mother. But Horace was quite a knowledgeable person, and he started a system that prevailed there for at least 2 years, and that is they started a mash brewing out in the Onion, and every Friday, as soon as the classes were over, there was a great rush. They'd made a pass key to the chemistry lab, and there was a great rush of getting this mash into the chemistry lab, and locked the door, and they brewed alcohol up there all day, all through Saturday and Sunday, then get it out on Sunday evening and returned it to the woods. So two brothers who were a class ahead of me, I think, or two class ahead of me, who were entrepreneurs, and they imported two girls from St. John one Sunday afternoon. They came out in a bus, and they sold the services of those girls around the school. That also operated out of the Onion. That just happened on one occasion, and it became too risky and too complicated. There were some interesting people at Rossi when I was there. There were the Diego brothers who just graduated, but when I got there, but I'd seen them around often before I'd gone to the school itself. And while I was there, the Beato boys, Jose and Roberto, I think it was, came. And after that, there was Jose, forgotten his last name, but it was very interesting on all occasions to watch them the first time it snowed. They go out and throw it up in the air and roll in it, and they thought it was great. They soon got over that. School in the old schoolhouse, and the new schoolhouse was built. The chapel was built first after World War I, and then the new schoolhouse was built, I guess, probably in about 1932. But it was quite an experience in the old schoolhouse. It was pretty creaky and odd. While I was there, there was a master called Fanny Keebly. He was an Englishman that came out and taught there, and he came back later again after I'd left. But a stray dog turned up at the school and was around for 2 or 3 days and became very attached to a lot of the boys, and then as it was a nuisance, Fanny got a piece of rope and put it around his neck and led him out to the woods and shot him one day, and all hell broke loose that night when they found out. And both the North House and the South House turned out and wouldn't go back in their houses, and they rang the school bell, and oh, there was open rebellion for about 2 hours with everybody milling about. And they wanted to get a piece of rope and lead Fanny out, and they were asking for volunteers to give them a gun. They were going to do the same thing to him that he'd done to their dog. Master, while I was there, was W.R. Hibbert, known as the Beak. And the Beak came out that evening and settled things down after he'd let them take that bit of the steam blow off on it. Just ahead of me at Rossay was his son, Jimmy Hibbert. And Jimmy was probably there the first, in the sixth form, the first year I was there. And Jimmy went off to RMC and died the second year he was there, I think. It was a very sad occasion, and we all turned up for the funeral. We had another student, a very good tennis player named Jerry Stanfield, came from Truro. And he also died at the school when I was there, and turned out big funeral performance to put his body on the train and ship him home to Truro. A number of years after I left, I think Jose Chartier was killed at the school when he was out cutting wood, and a chunk of wood dropped on his head. It was a very soft skull, and it killed him. He didn't die immediately, went to the hospital and then died. Damn. was at school, and for a number of years after that, I did a lot of hunting and fishing mostly throughout Kings County. But also while I was at school and for a short while afterwards, I ran trap lines. I trapped muskrats down at the culvert at the mouth of Taylor's Brook, and up in the area in the Rossi Park, and up in Henderson's Creek, and even as far off as the lake at Ritchie Lake at Kuspamsis.